This episode of the Crown Refs podcast is brought to you by RefereeStore.com. To save 15% on all United Attire products, enter Crown15 at checkout. We hope you enjoy this episode and do us one last favor before you listen. Have a great rest of your day.
Hi, this is G League and NCAA Men's Official Christina Sparza. Thank you for listening to the Crown Refs podcast. Serve the game.
Thank you for listening to the Crown Refs podcast, the audio experience for basketball officials, and welcome back to episode 8 of the Wonderful Women of Officiating, a series dedicated to highlighting some of the amazing accomplishments of the females in our officiating community and some of the great work that they're doing both on and off the court. I am here today with G League and NCAA Men's official Christine Esparza. Christine, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I've been following you for a few years. I know you've been following me. I feel like we know each other, so this is a nice natural connection, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about your journey and what is in store with you tonight. So appreciate having you here, and we got a couple other people joining our session, so welcome, Corey. So, Christine, I just want to start with kind of like your journey through officiating. Why did you start? Who told you to start? Who gave you the idea? What were some of that, origin stories of how you got into officiating? I know 12 years ago, you're a 12th year official. So why don't you just take us through that, and you can stop right at this latest chapter before you became an NCAA men's Division I official.
Perfect. Okay. So yeah, I do not come from any lineage of officials or knowing officials until I became an official, but I was in recreation. My entire family plays basketball, coached, played at the collegiate level. So my relationship with basketball has always been either player or coach, and definitely a fan, growing up, but never an official. I was working in recreation at the time, 12 years ago. I was going through school, getting my master's. So I was still trying, kind of figuring things out as far as like, where my life is going. And so I was overseeing all of our youth sports and our adult league sports. So I was assigning our scorekeepers and our officials, even though I didn't know them, and I really didn't know what they did other than officiate our game, right? So I have a list, and I'm calling them like, hey, are you available? And I'm assigning them. So I'm scorekeeping for a men's league, and the officials, you see them every week, two times a week sometimes, depending on how many nights a week there's games. And every time they're like, you know a lot about the game, you should referee. And I'm like, heck no, I'm not being no referee. Never. Like, I don't even know where to start, Like, I coach, that's about it. So then fast forward a few years, because I was working in recreation since high school until I started refereeing full time, and then, teaching and whatnot. But anyway, fast forward like maybe two summers, and I still had to answer to someone. I had a boss. And our referees didn't show up for youth games, like maybe fifth and sixth grade or whatever. So my boss is like, here, put this shirt on. I'm going to call some other guys that I know and just referee until they get here. And I was like, I'm not doing that because the parents are crazy. Like, I've coached in this league. I know how the parents are. And he's like, no, don't worry about it. I'll give you the ref pay. And your salary rate, right? So I was like, okay, whatever. He gives me like the old school shirt that had like the collar that zips up and like a whistle that had the little P in it, and I'm just like, whatever. I got this thing. I put the shirt on over, my my work shirt, and I could probably got on like jeans or like khaki shorts or whatever. And I'm out there refereeing, and like you have no idea at that time. Well, for me specifically, I'm gonna speak for myself, but like the amount of decision making and then like just the sequencing of everything, seeing something, blowing the whistle, giving a signal, letting everybody know what you have and what I, and so like it was just crazy, but it was so fun. I actually really enjoyed it. So then when the when one referee showed up, I stayed to do the second game with him. And then after that, you know, I told my boss, like, hey, if we don't have referees again, like, I don't mind. Plus, I was getting like double pay. So I was like, you know, I don't mind filling in again. So then, so I did a few games that summer. Then when men's league fall started, the officials, of course, I'm scorekeeping. Hey, you know, because it was like clockwork, they would always ask me, you know, you should officiate. We're looking for women. The women are moving really fast. Da, da, da. And I said, hey, you know, like, what do I got to do? Like, how much do you guys get? Like, how much do you guys get paid? And, you know, because at the time, like, everything was cash. And unfortunately, like, I was making as much then as pretty much people are still making for like rec ball leagues now. But it's a little bit of an increase. But, you know, it was like $25 then. So they're like, no, you make, you know, whatever it was for varsity and JV, probably like 71 or $80, right? And you got to go to these classes and then you get certified and that's it. I'm like, all right, cool. Sign me, let me know when to sign up. And so I went to the first meeting. I didn't know anybody there. And then like the first year, the first two seasons was, I mean, pretty much what was expected, I guess. Like I, the shirt, the referee shirt, the stripes that I got was from Justin Van Dyne because he came from the same high school unit and he came to like guest speak and he was like giving out his old uniforms for like people who are answering questions, you know. So like I didn't purchase my whole uniform my first year. Like everything was donated to me. And even like the black slacks, like I refused at the time to go buy them. So I had like express like business slacks without belt loops, you know. It was just like anyway. So then so I really enjoyed the first year. I had like a pretty full schedule, even though I kind of like really didn't know what I was doing. And then the second year I like kind of paid attention more in class and like still trying to learn the rules that we're learning in like in our classes. And I just remember that second year, like one of the other officials that was like a third or fourth year official came up to me and was like, hey, I've been hearing about you. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, do you know who Violet Palmer is? And at the time I'm like, no, I have no idea, you know? And because my high school unit is it's not LA City or anything like that. We are like on the outskirts, like kind of a suburb of SoCal. And they're like, well, you should know if you want to be a real referee, like you need to know who all the women that came before you. And like, she works in the NBA and she's the first woman to get hired in the NBA. And I'm like, oh, dang, that's really cool. At the time, I'm like, I watched the NBA like very religiously, but like, I was not paying attention to referees. And even when I started refereeing, I wasn't paying attention to other referees watching game. I, you know, I showed up to my games and worked like, you know, 10 AAU games on the weekends and like that's just kind of the start. So then I don't want to bore you guys with all of this, but like the following season is when I really started to like take it serious. Like, okay, I need to learn the rules because I started getting more opportunities within my high school unit. I was, you know, working varsity games. And then by my third year, my assigner at the time, like very progressive, was like putting me on boys varsity games, which he did with a few other women that came from my unit. But you know, it's still kind of at that time was still kind of uncommon, you know. So I was just like, I gotta take this more seriously. And I had gone to camps, you know, after my second year of working high school. And so I'm like, okay, I got picked up in junior college and like I'm like I need to really buckle down. Like I need to know what I'm doing out here. Plus like there's a guy named Samson Brew at the time who had seen me, and he was like, "You're doing a disservice to the game if you don't know these rules." And I'm like, at the back then, you know, you're just like, "I'm just trying to work these games. I'm having fun. I'm making money. Like, I'm around the game. Like, it's cool." But he was totally right, you know. So, I had a girls' varsity game, and this is like to everybody: you never know who's in the gym, and it could be your high school games you're working. It could be like AAU, men's league, whatever the case. You literally never know who's in the gym. So I just got finished working a girls' varsity game, and you know, a lot of times you share the locker room with the men's crew that's coming in for the boys' varsity game. So we're all in there a little bit, you know, and this guy comes in. It's like, "Hey," he introduces himself, and he's like, "You ever thought about refereeing in the NBA?" And here I'm like, I've only refereed, like I said, like some high school varsity, and I'm a few years in, and I'm just like, "Yeah, sure," you know, but I started paying attention more to referees at this point. So I'm just like, "Yeah, I mean, that would be a dream, but you know, I'm just trying to get varsity games at this point. I want all boys varsity games." And he's like, "Here, take my card. If you know, if you really want to do it, like, contact me." So I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "You know, you do a good job. I see a lot of potential. You're very green, but like, there's a lot of potential there." So I'm like, "Okay." The next year I got the invite to like grassroots. And so I went to grassroots. And in the meantime, you know, every summer, like around this time, you're figuring out which camps you're going to. I will say that like after my second year of refereeing high school, I went to camps like at least four or more camps every summer. So I was getting hired and like trying to put myself in that position, like, you know, to get to the next level. And most of that at that time was like all training camps and learning opportunities. And then it kind of just is like, you get hired and you work a few games at the next level. So that's really like how I got my start. But it was very, like I said, I don't come from a lineage of like officials at all. When my family found out I started officiating, they were just like, my sister literally was like, "You've joined the dark side." And I was like, "I mean, are you going to support me or not?" Like,
so. I remix that. It's now the light side.
Yes. No, I totally agree. And like now they're way more self-aware of their comments to officials when they go to games, because she still coaches and she's like pretty tough on officials. And like her and my brother-in-law actually have like at the time had very winning high school programs. Once they started learning I officiated, they were just like, "Do you know this ref? Do you know this ref?" And then as I started going to camps, like, "Hey, do you know my sister? She coaches at, you know, it's here and there." They're like, their face was like, "Yeah, I know her. Yeah, I've given her a few teas." I'm like, "Yeah, probably well deserved."
That's great, Christine. I appreciate you sharing. Yeah. So tell us who came to the locker room and how did the grassroots tryout go?
Yeah, so JB Caldwell came into the locker room at that time, and
big shout out to JB, by the way. JB, yes. How are you, sir?
Yes, big shout out to JB. And I was very fortunate. When I went to grassroots, I progressed to mid-level and then elite, and then I got hired on my first go around.
For sure.
Yeah. So
that's awesome. So that's like your fourth or fifth year in officiating, and you're already
It was my fourth year in officiating, yeah.
How did you feel going into that first season?
Going first year into the G League?
Yeah, just, I mean, that's a very high level to work in year four, so.
Yes. So the other part that I did kind of fail to mention, which is like a huge part of this actually, is that after my second year of working high school ball, I went to the Pro-Am down in LA. And for the first summer, I didn't work any games, no games. And I was down there every weekend just sitting and watching. And it's kind of changed since then, but like back then it was kind of just the thing you did. And one of the major influences also during that time was like Ed Rush. He had Port Club out here and he would do a lot of these trainings and things. And, you know, JT Orr and Justin Van Dyne came from my same high school unit, and they all worked at the Pro-Am. And, you know, they always say, like, success leaves clues. So I'm going to do whatever they did to try and get where they're at. So I went down to the Pro-Am every summer. The first summer, like I said, I never worked. I didn't get on the court one time. I bought my whole uniform. I printed the whole NBA book, like printed it out, because I didn't have access to actual, like, the rule book. And oh my gosh. But yeah. So anyway, so to answer your question though, I felt somewhat prepared, but nothing prepares you for your first season in the G League. I don't care how much Pro-Am you do. It, like, the pace of play, I vividly remember after my first G League game, like, my calves were so sore because it was like full on sprint the entire game, like the entire game, you know? And I couldn't believe how, I thought I was like so ready. And I remember George Tolliver was actually at my first game, and our morning meeting, he's like, "So how do you feel?" And I was like, "I mean, I feel good. I'm a little nervous, but I feel good." And he was like, "Your eyes aren't ready yet. You're going to be surprised. Those eyes are going to be wide open." And I'm like, "Okay." You know, my game was at Santa Cruz, which is like one of my favorite places and like one of the best G League venues to go to. They sell out every game. They have a great following there. The first time I ever got booed was in that arena, not that year, later on, but like, it was just crazy, like the adrenaline rush and then just the crowd and then the speed of play and everything. It was, I mean, you can be as prepared as you want to be, but then it's just like, you have to decompress after, like, after that first game.
So how, so you made the G League in year four. Tell me about your NCAA women's journey. Where were you along the path at that time? And, you know, how did you get to D1?
Yeah, so I was hired in Division II on down, all the small college stuff, my third year. And then I didn't get hired until Division I until a year after I was already in the G League. And I got picked up in two conferences out west. And but I had gone to, like, the thing about, like, the journey is always, like, you know, you kind of, I did have a, like, quick, I guess, you know, like, journey, but at the same time, like, there's camps that I've been to four or five times before I got hired, you know, and there's still camps. And then there was opportunities where, like, I went one time and got hired, and there was camps I didn't even go to, and then I got hired. So, like, you know, you still just have to do the work. But in the meantime of pursuing the G League and the pro game, I was going to women's camps every summer.
While we're on the camp topic, I know a lot of people on the call and listening are getting ready for camp season. So what advice or tips would you have to all of the officials that are getting ready to go and either try out or go to instructional camps?
Yeah, so I would treat instructional camps and hiring camps, you know, I would treat them the same, because you never know what opportunity can come out of it. And like I said before, you never know who's in the gym. There literally could be an assigner in there that's looking for either, you know, new and young officials, or just, they're just looking for officials. So definitely be prepared. All your preparation starts, like, definitely give yourself a rest period when your season ends. But when you start to prepare for camp, like, really prepare for camp, you know, I know at the time when I was going through the camp process, you know, you're working a ton of, like, AAU ball and, like, rec leagues and stuff like that. I would say really hone in on, like, being sharp with your signals, running, because your habits are built in those games. And until you get to a point where you can really, like, it's a switch where you can turn it off and on, it early in your career, you can't. And those little habits of looking, like, lazy or nonchalant, not looking sharp, will really seep in when you're on the stage of when it matters, you know? So to prepare for camp, I would definitely say, like, just work games, work and really challenge yourself, like, to, if you can. I know we don't really have too much control over where we can work, but try and put yourself out there. Work in leagues that are going to challenge you. Like, if it's older, like honestly, I feel like the hardest leagues to work are like the 40 and over leagues. You know, because like they just, there's more physicality and they don't play like they think they're playing. And so they're fouls. And then now you got to use your communication skills and your diffusing skills, because you want to go back there and, you know, you don't want to just be whacking everybody. So, but like really challenge yourself to prepare yourself as much as you can for camp, because there's always going to be like a level of nervousness for something new. But the more prepared you are, you know, I think that just makes that experience a lot, like you'll be more successful.
And what would you tell the official that is, you know, anticipating or excited to maybe make a league or get hired, and then they find out that they didn't get hired, they weren't on that list, they didn't get that email? What would you tell an official kind of in your circle about bouncing back from that and moving forward?
Yeah. I know in the moment that it's like, it can be discouraging. But like, I really use it as motivation and your own self-assessment. As much as you'll get critiqued from other people and you're getting feedback from, you know, people at camp, the clinicians and everything else, like sometimes I knew there were times that I didn't go as prepared as I thought I was, you know, but do all the things. That's another thing, like do all the things that got you to that point. Like don't all of a sudden now, cause you made it there, they're like, you're not studying your rules as much, or you're not in the mirror working on your signals as much. Like continue to do all those things, and only you can self-assess to know, like, you know, what the reason is. I also think when you get that, like, try not to be discouraged, be in that moment of like, oh dang, this sucks, but then you got to move forward and like use that as motivation to just get better, because you have to just do the work. And you can always get better. There was always something when you were at camp that you can improve, that maybe they were looking for someone, not so much that was a play caller, but who could talk to coaches and diffuse situations, you know? But if it was your play calling, and then you got to figure out why your play calling wasn't that great, you know, was I being undisciplined and not looking at in my primary, and like, I didn't see my defenders the longest, so now I'm jumping at plays, or, you know, whatever the case, was my fitness not where it should have been or it could have been. There's so many factors that kind of go into reasons why you aren't hired in that moment, and a lot of it just really comes down to timing. And I think that comes with experience of being here, like, at, you know, hearing that early on, I didn't want to hear that at all. I'm like, the timing, like, I'm working so hard, you know, but it does come down to a lot of timing as well. But if, you know, you just have to really self-assess and use that as motivation too, to just like try the next time. I mean, you can't let the first failure stop you.
I love that. I also want to shout out your friend and a big inspiration to me, to the industry, is Crystal Hogan.
Yes.
Take me through your decision to move from NCAA women's to NCAA men's. When did you get the idea, and how did you kind of follow through with that process?
Yeah, so actually about like 6 years ago now, I had gotten an invite to the West Coast Consortium men's tryout. At the time, there was no women at all working. It was like the year before Crystal got invited. And I didn't get hired, which kind of, like I said, like kind of sucked, but I was just like, I was working women. So I was just like, hey, I'm just trying to increase my schedule on the women's side. And which I did, you know, I got hired in more conferences. I got more games. Like, it was always, you know, we're always trying to do the next thing. And then I'm like, I want to be a crew chief. I want to work postseason, all those things. So, and since then, I really hadn't thought about working men's. When Crystal got hired, I thought it was great. And I was like, so happy for her. And at the time I was just like, man, it's about time. You know, when I first went to my first camp, it was all combined, for out here, for like small college, the men and women are at the same camp. And like, when you get on a crew, you're kind of just like, hey, are we doing women's mechanics or men's mechanics. I remember an assigner who assigns both asked me, he was just trying to get to know me, and I was like, hey, I want to try out for the men's, like I want to work men's college. And it was like, that's not really an option. And so kind of just by default, which, is very common. This was 12 years ago. So like, it's very common. Or I mean, it was just common that like the default is you just work women. So I kind of, like I said, I just went the women's route. So when Crystal got hired, I was just like, man, it's about time. And then it made me think of like the time I tried out. And of course, like, as an official, you kind of go through that, like, well, dang, I wonder why they didn't hire me. But I didn't really give it a second thought. Because I was still, I mean, I'm still in the G League, so I'm still pursuing like the NBA. And then this past season, I was Crystal has talked to me since she got hired, and I was like, I'm just like, I've worked so hard on the women's side, I don't want to leave. Like, I don't want to leave yet. I've worked so hard to get where I'm at that I want to see how much further I can go. It's like, okay, well, when you're ready, you come talk to me. So like the last 2 summers when I see her at Drewley, she's always talking about it. And
I feel like you guys are always were plotting that at the Drew League in the summertime.
that's Crystal. She was definitely plotting this whole time. I think she kept like planting the seed until I finally was like, maybe so. Because the other thing is that like I moved to the Midwest 5 years ago, and I just really was like homesick. I wanted to get back home. And even though I was working like West Coast games on the women's side, and I was working everywhere. And I would come home for the summers, like, so I could work the pro-am, because that's just part of my training. And like, I just wanted to continue to do the things that I did, So when she talked to me about it, I was like, if it gets me back home, like, I think I'll give it a try. Like, if I can work men's basketball, like get hired in the West Coast Consortium, they invite me to camp, I'm gonna go. She's like, well, what? Because that was the first thing. Well, if you get invited, like, would you go? Or are you gonna decline? And I remember the year before that, I told her I would decline, because where I was at on the women's side. So then last year, as the season ended, I was really just like, I'm trying to move back home. And if it presents itself, like, I'll go through the process, So I went through the process.
Congratulations. That's truly amazing. I'm rooting
Yeah,
for
thank
you.
you.
I'm like proud of you. Like I love seeing that kind of stuff. And when I saw the Crystal's news story pop up in 2019, I was like, oh my God, there's no women that work men's? Yeah, I guess
Right.
not. It was incredible. So I tell a lot of the female officials that I speak with or that have aspirations to work high level college that there's a big opportunity on the men's side.
There
There's
is.
huge, especially on all levels. On all levels, like on my college board, there's no officials. There's no female officials. I've never even seen a female try out.
Yeah.
So it's a big opportunity. So you mentioned Crystal, excuse me, obviously an influence on you. Who else has inspired you along your journey and helped coach you to where you are now?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure, Crystal, because she's kind of been around like the entire time from the first time I went to the pro-am. And we actually both worked women's at the time too, until she switched over to the men's side. Early on in my career, like I said, I mentioned like
What's that?
influences of like Violet Palmer, Brenda Pantoja, like was huge because she's Latina. She's just from down the freeway. Actually, her and my sister were like rivals in high school, which I found out, and like always competing for like the leading score in there, like at the time. So, and then she, at that time, she was working, NBA preseason games. She was working in the G League. She was working the W. She was working like tournament in college. So it was just like, I want to be her. And I part of me was just like, I look like her. And that's the other thing too, like as a younger official, you're like, we're stealing things from everybody, right? Like signals and our running and all these other things. But at some point, you know, you have to just like, okay, well, who is Christine as far as the official? Like, what are some of my own signals and like that type of thing? But I mean, those were huge influences in my career of like where I wanted to go, where I could see myself, you know. And then when I got into the pro program, Mark Davis has been a huge influence and mentor. You know, if I have anything crazy, I know I can call him and he'll let me like vent or cry or whatever I need, you know, or ask him about plays and, you know, whatever else. And then Randy Richardson, who was in the G League, but works on the men's side, he's also one of like my go-to people as well. And then Tommy Nunez, who works in the NBA, worked in the WNBA. There's a big Latino basketball like circuit out here. And so in the off season, I referee a lot in that, and I'm a part of that. That was also where I kind of got like, you never know who's in the gym. I go work at this charity event. I had just learned like three person. So this was still like maybe second or third year in. And they host a big tournament, and like Billy Kennedy is like leaning up against the wall. I have no idea who he is though. And then after the game, he's like calls me over. He's like, how long you been refereeing? I tell him, he's like, oh, okay. You ever thought about refereeing in the NBA? I was like, oh my God, I had someone this season. Just tell me that. I was like, no, but it's starting to cross my mind now. And he's like, well, yeah, you know, I think you should. I'm like, okay. So I watched Billy a lot just because like the people who talk to you and kind of like notice you end up like looking for them on the TV, right? Or like trying to watch their games and learn things and take things from them. So they all had a pretty big influence in, you know, how I wanted to officiate. And like some of them all have different communication styles and like different court presence, but I feel like there was something I wanted to take from all of them.
That's great. And with officiating, there's no way you can do it by yourself. You have to have great people in your corner. I like
Yeah.
that two people mentioned to you about the NBA, and that kind of put it in your ecosystem and put it on your dashboard of it maybe being possible. So without
Right.
those ideas, you know, it might have took you another year or two to come across that. So you mentioned communication, and one of the biggest things you've learned from officiating, we have a series devoted to effective game management and communication with coaches. It's called Rapid Responses. It's kind of our way of trying to help give officials the tools and resources to better manage a game and be in more control of the conversations. So share with us some of your strategies and tips that have helped you be better at communication and conflict resolution.
Yeah, so like first and foremost, always be professional. And your professionalism like starts literally when you walk into the gym and show up to the game, you know. But like your professionalism in the verbiage that you use when you communicate with the coach, your tone, and then also just your body language. And also, as I've like gone through experiences, you know, really separating your emotions from heated incidences, right? Like, so that has really helped in treating like giving technical fouls. When early on it was like, oh my gosh, don't give a technical foul, or it's like this big thing, but now it's like it's just another foul. And you know, if you take away that emotion, because that's what's fueled the technical on the other end, and you can't necessarily match that energy, you know. And at the end of the day, like we're held to a different standard than the players and the coaches. So communication, as far as like listening first, be a responder, don't be an initiator. And 9 times out of 10, a lot of times they just really want to vent. And if you're just like, hey, I hear you, coach, or give a like head nod. And I kind of try to stay away from telling people like, oh, did they ask you a question? Because you don't want to tell a coach, are you asking me a question? It could come off a little dismissive, you know, but it's like I always also, I learned this from JT Orr, is when a coach is complaining or upset about something, always try to find one thing that you can agree with them on and then tell them what you have, right? Like, so the one I can, like, I know happens a lot, well, for me anyway, is like, there'll be a play where like, oh, it's all ball. That was all ball. And I'm like, you know, there was a lot of ball, but he got his wrist. So I'm finding one thing to agree with, but I'm telling you why this is a foul, or I'm telling you why I have to address that behavior. Most recently, this past year in the G League, had a game where like, we have F2, this kid gets ejected. Well, he's not a kid. This guy gets ejected. And the coach is like, well, did you see what happened before? And I'm like, yeah, I did. But that doesn't mean he can go clock somebody with his elbow. You know, I did see that. So I'm finding something to agree with him, where now he doesn't think it's just like him against me. And then I'm explaining to him what I have, what I see. This is why we're making this decision, you know, or why I've made the decision, you know. So.
And I like that you're agreeing with the coach and you're leading with the agreement, because maybe if you give your opinion of the play first, then you agree, it's not going to be as effective. So it's just a good approachable way to capture their attention first and kind of de-escalate, and then you give them your interpretation of what happened. So I'm going to use that myself.
Yeah.
What else you got for us as far as just managing difficult personalities, whether players or coaches?
Something I stole from somebody else was awareness leads to fairness, and our awareness in a game will lead to fairness. And that can just be from like understanding lopsided situations. It could be from understanding that you might have just put a quote unquote cheap foul on an impact player. It could be the awareness of knowing that we had a play down here that we know called that looks like a foul, not saying it's a foul, but we know call it. And we come down on the other end and, you know, the basketball gods made it similar and we put a freaking whistle on it. Sorry, I didn't want to almost cuss, but we put a whistle on it, right? And now the first thing is like, you guys are being inconsistent. So our awareness in the game will lead to fairness. And there's just going to be times that our concentration is not high the entire time, you know, but the more you can have a high level of concentration and recognize what's going on in the game, it will just lead to fairness in most instances, if you can, you know, knowing when there's lopsided foul situation, different styles of play, knowing that if the coach asks about that, like, what's going to be your response? So kind of got a little sidetracked. Sorry.
It's okay.
Am I on the right path? I'm like, wait, what are they talking about?
You're on a great path. And I want to put you on the spot and just throw a couple comments at you as if I was the coach. And I would love to hear how you would respond.
Okay.
Christine, you guys got to be consistent.
Coach, what do you think is not being, what do you think we haven't been consistent with? I'm going to put it back on him. I'm going to let him answer the question for me.
Well, we're getting hit on this one end. You don't call it. And then we come down on this side and your partner has a foul. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. So are we missing plays for you?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we'll talk about it. I don't see it the same way, but we'll talk about it the next time out.
I appreciate you talking to me. Fast forward. one minute later.
Hopefully that works. I feel like I'm better in the heat of the moment. I feel like a little pressure right now, but
good. I hope you feel the pressure. I mean, I'm happy to bring you the pressure. I'm just kidding. This is nothing. This is very helpful for us all, because, you know, we discuss these same comments, because really coaches only have 10 or 12 comments for us. We've all heard the 10 or 12. They just say it 1,000 different ways. So, Christine, the foul count is 7-4. Are you serious?
Coach, I'm very, you know, sometimes I am a little sassy. So I will say how I would say it on a court. Coach, I'm very serious and I'm very aware of the foul count. Do you think we're missing plays on your end?
Of course I think you're missing plays. I mean, the fouls are 7-4. How do you explain that?
Well, you guys are playing man to man and you're missing a few shots. They're hitting shots. I don't know what else to tell you, coach.
All right, fine. Fast forward 47 seconds later.
I'm getting out of there.
Christine, how's your partner going to call that from all the way on the other side of the court?
You would be best asking him, but he definitely had a different look, so I can't answer for him.
Oh, come on. I mean, come on. He's calling it from way outside, and he's 40 feet away.
Well, it was a foul. He saw something that we just didn't see. You would have to ask him.
I appreciate you talking to me.
You're welcome, coach. And then a
There
wink.
you go. I like that. Smooth, smooth. Very good. Guys, what other ones do we want to hear? Feel free to unmute and ask Christine either a question or a response you'd like to hear from her.
Yeah.
What do you got, Juan?
Hey, Christine, I'm a big fan of yours, especially the jewelry work.
Oh, thank you, Juan. Thank you.
I have a question. Working so many different places, like, you work in the G League, and then maybe you work in a college game the next night. How do you handle the mechanics of one night to the other? Is it just practice? Does it take time? I'm kind of struggling with that right now with high school and college. Hopefully done with high school, but it's different. It's different mechanics on both of them. How do you handle that yourself? And then also, I guess like a follow-up to that, how do you handle like criticism from within, observers or people that, don't like that, and you accidentally slip up and you're walking and reporting compared to, I think, men's college, you kind of jog a little. So how do you go about that?
So I'll address the first one about, when they kind of get on you on the difference of like signals and mechanics. Just like, hey, I'm working both. I'm kind of slipping up. I gotta get better at like being able to separate them. Always take the onus. Because at, certain levels when I was still doing high school, like there were times you well, I was just pointing, I'm not stopping the clock, and to them they feel like you're being disrespectful to that level, right? And so you're like, I'm not, I just like I have these habits, and I'm trying to break them. Always take the responsibility and put the onus on you. For me to separate them, it just takes a lot of like day of game preparation. In the off season, I will say when I'm working like a 2 or 3 game set with somebody, I'm like, and I know they work different leagues as well with different sets of signals and different sets of mechanics. We'll do 1 game where it's all pro, right? And then the next game we'll do all college. And that it helps you start to learn how to switch it on and off in that 2 hour time period, right? So now when you have a game one day, it's a little bit easier to like, oh yeah, I gotta stop the clock now. And I gotta put my fist up and then punch, or I'm just pointing. But the preparation is more so in the day of. So like on a day where I had a G League game, I would do at least 5 to 10 minutes of signals in my hotel room and then in the locker room just to make sure like my mindset is ready for pro rules, pro signals, walking and talking and reporting. And then in a college game, same thing. I'm working on stopping the clock because I want all of that to still look sharp. I want it to all still look like I have strength. I don't want it to look like I'm confused or like, oh shoot, which one am I doing now? But the reality is that we form these habits, right? And we're working on being really good at college signals. And then you end up learning a new set of signals and you're like, I'm trying to learn this, and your old habits kind of creep in. So it's just a matter of practicing turning those on and off. And I would use a lot of like my rec games or whatever other games where you can kind of work on those things to work on it. And you don't have to do this, but early on, I would like me and my partners, we would like say, like, you're gonna owe $5 at the end of the game, like, if you don't, like, for however many misses. So it kind of, there's like a little, you gotta put a little wager to like get you to focus more.
That's a great question, Juan.
Ooh,
Hey,
thank you.
is your background from the TV show The Office?
It is. That's Stanley in the
I thought that was
back.
Stanley.
No, Stanley, we said, hey.
So, Christine, just to follow up Juan's question, I know it's very difficult bouncing back and forth. So now you're doing G League NCAA men's. Would you say you're 100% accurate from a signals and mechanics perspective on both sides? Or is there one that you need to, is there a certain, aspect that you need to work on?
I mean, I try to be, but I'm definitely good for at least like the first whistle in a G game of putting my hand up to stop the clock, and vice versa. Like the first whistle in a men's college game, I'm probably just gonna point right out of bounds versus like stopping the
Okay.
clock. But once I get that one out of my system, then for the most part, I'm pretty much like locked in on my signals and mechanics.
Because I mean, like a charge, one night you're not stopping the clock, you're punching, and then the next
Right.
night you're stopping the clock and going behind the head. So I mean, that
Yes.
takes muscle.
It does. Oh my gosh. And I had to practice that so much because I wear my hair in a ponytail, and every time my hand will like hit my ponytail, so then I started like practicing like below, like at the first time it was like on the side of my head. I was like, this looks so goofy. It looks goofy already, you know, just like, yeah. But I mean, you cannot dismiss like mirror work. You just have to, you know, you got to do the mirror work. Repetition, repetition, repetition.
Absolutely. Pedro, it is good that you joined us on the call. Pedro is getting ready to change over from NCAA men's to NCAA
Okay.
women's to NCAA women. So maybe he has a question to ask you, or maybe he's just going to leave his mic on mute and we won't hear anything. Let's see. Okay. He's listening in
Putting people
tonight.
on the
That's it.
spot,
He's not
Paul.
available. He's not available.
I'm
There he
sorry.
is.
I'm
He's
at my
coming.
son's baseball game. I'm sorry.
I got a question.
Okay.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. My name is let me put my video on.
Feel free to show your face, Corey.
My question is, when you got into the G League, what part of your game took the longest to translate? Like communication, play calling, like what was kind of the most difficult part?
That's a great question. I would actually say that the communication and diffusing situations would be the biggest one because the pro game is a players league, right? At every level, W, G League, NBA, I guess for FIBA, I don't work FIBA, but like it's a players league where high school and college, these are coaches leagues, right? So I would say that would be the biggest, that was the one I had to really like work on more so because your interactions are more so with the players versus the coaches. Now, don't get me wrong, the coaches talk to you and you still gotta like diffuse situations with them. But in college, you know, every now and then you might have a situation with a player. You're more so learning how to manage the coaches in the college game, right? So I would say that would, and that's a great question. Yeah. But the play calling for me, obviously, the speed of play, I was working women's at the time. So the speed of play, the pace, just that is all a trend, like an adjustment. You just have, and also the guidelines for how the games are called, you know, so that's a, like just a mindset adjustment as well.
Thank you.
Corey, your shape up looks great, man. Your barber, you should pat him on the back. Does a
I
nice
appreciate
job.
that. You as well.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, do the best I can, what, who else we got? Cam, Josh, Michael, Alan, do you have any questions you'd like to ask Christine?
Yeah, I got one. So you talked a little bit about game day prep and all that. Obviously, some of this is going to be tailored towards the matchup and stuff, but when you have your pre-game meeting with your partners, what are some things you like to touch on and focus on going into each game?
Yeah, so definitely matchups. If we know the teams and we kind of know their styles of play, you know, you're not putting a target on anybody's back, but you also don't want to be surprised in any game. You want to be prepared. So aside from matchups, we'll talk about also like the points of emphasis or things like for the G League. We'll get memos about, you know, traveling, screening, those type of things, or they'll send us plays and we'll watch those and talk about them as a crew. We also bring plays to our meetings, and you know, if it's a tough coverage play, we'll talk about how we want to cover that play, and how to be the most successful at getting that play right. So we'll talk about that as well. If we had any like rules kind of situations, we'll kind of touch on rules as well. So, but yeah, definitely the points of emphasis, rules, matchups, and then game management, right? We'll talk about coaches and players. Like, you know, we don't all want to give the coach our ear every single time. Like, we all have to know when there's a line in the sand. And it's the same for players. So we'll just kind of like lightly discuss those things. But that's something I will go over even in a college game. And depending if I'm like the crew chief or not, I'll still always try to, you know, have something to add to the pregame.
Thank you.
Christine, what would you say to people that overvalue the crew chief and then undervalue themselves when they're not the crew chief? Because I hear a lot of officials like, oh, I didn't make that call because I wasn't the R on the game, or vice versa. When they are the R, sometimes they're doing too much. So just speak upon everybody being the R or the crew chief.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I've been in that situation. I've been there. I've said that exact thing before, you know, so it's definitely relatable, I think, at every level. But also know that like the game, there's so many plays like with pivots and turns and that plays close. And when you start to understand that a play may be close to you is open to someone else and vice versa. And just understand, when you understand the mechanics and actually work the mechanics, then you know that. And I think like the biggest thing is, why I know like when we get critiqued or whatever, when we get feedback, it is like, you have double whistles, but they're primary whistles. They would rather hear like the cadence whistle because, you know, now they know that you saw it, but you gave the person a chance, right? So, but the crew chief, yes, they have like certain responsibilities and certain things fall on them. Like they kind of have like the last word or the last say so, but that should never be the reason why you're not working. Like the game comes first. So I'm sure you guys have all heard it, and I know it's kind of like, but game comes first, your partners, and then yourself. So you want to do what's best for the game. And if a call needs to be made, you know, quote unquote, in front of someone, just do it with the cadence, do it with how you've been trained, how where we learn how to play call.
What else haven't we discussed that you would like to elaborate on? Anything else that we've missed?
Let me see.
I mean, we got partnering. We'd love to hear you speak maybe a little bit about being a great partner.
Yeah.
You seem like a great partner.
Oh, thank you. I would like to say that like I am a great partner. And you know, that's like one of the things, like as soon as you get your assignments, you hardly look at where you're at. You look at who you're with first.
True. Yeah.
You know, and I really strive to like when people see their schedule and they see my name on there, I want them to be excited and like, yes, you know. And plus like the other caveat to that is some of these games are wars and you're like, this is who I want to go to battle with, you know, because at all the outside noise, everybody in the world is trying to divide us on that court. The players are, the coaches, the fans. So like, if you can be just a good partner, even if you don't like that person, but no, you know, like it's a joke, but it's a little, you know, but you just have to be a good partner. And being a good partner is like having your partner's back on the court, just making them look good. When you make your partners look good, you look good and your whole crew looks good. You know, it's very obvious when you can tell that, like, there is some discourse between a crew. So one of the ways I think is, you know, goes with that first email or text message, depending on where you work and whatever the kind of protocol is, you know, reaching out. And regardless if you're the R, the one, the U 99, you know, if you haven't heard from them, like, don't take it personal. I haven't heard from this, like, the R yet. Like, just reach out and touch base, you know? And then when you're in the locker room, like, just kind of have small talk a little bit. Like, we're all going to talk basketball, but if you don't know them, like, try to get to know them, because there's still plenty of games in college that I've never met these people, you know? So I always try to get to know them a little bit. And then, the biggest thing for, like, our crew to be successful is when we're comfortable. When we all feel comfortable on the court, like, we're going to have a pretty successful game. And even if the game is going left, you know, if we have a level of comfortability with each other and knowing, like, we're doing our best and we're doing what we can out here, like, the game is going to be what it's going to be.
Thank you for sharing that. Does anybody else have any questions for Christine? Anything else you guys like to ask her? We got Corey. Corey, you want me to ask your question, Corey, or would you like to unmute again?
No, I didn't want to step on your toes, so I typed it in. What advice would you give a young aspiring official?
I'm going to keep it simple. Be a sponge. Be a student of the game. Be a sponge. I would say, like, keep your mouth shut in a way that, like, don't be a yeah, but person, right? When they ask you da 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 da, and you're like, yeah, but I saw this. Like, just take the information. But for sure, be a sponge, be a student of the game, and do the work, because everybody's journey, I know it's so cliche, but literally everybody's journey is different. And there's just some intangible things that you have to have and that are going to be a part of everybody's journey. But if your standards for yourself and your work will get you to where you want to be, you know, when it comes down to, like, your fitness, your rules, knowledge, play calling, doing the video work, and then talking to people, like, you have to have a support system. You have to have a village, even if that's not, like, referees. When you're at, like, at home, you have to have people that support you and want to see you be successful and win too, because these games can be brutal. Like, the people outside of referees are brutal. It's tough. So yeah, but if an aspiring official can get past year three, then, like, the rest is history. They could do it,
because 70% quit after 3 years due to abuse from coaches and fans. So maybe year three.
Is that the statistic?
That's the stat.
It's tough. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm trying to get, like, officials all the time. And, like, I mean, I think that's probably true to the stat. I think after year two, they're like, it wasn't really for me.
Yeah. That's why you need that strong support system to lift you up.
Yes, definitely. Sure. And, like, I don't know if it's the same for the guys, but there was, like, definitely a few games early in my career, I'm just like, I can't believe this happened, you know? I can't believe this coach said this, or this fan. Like, I've heard some crazy things, like, just ignorant things, you know? And it's like, sometimes you just get in your feelings. Other days it bounces right off you. And some days it's like, I didn't sign up for this. You know, I'm just trying to do what I love. I just want to call the game. I just like being out here and, you know, being a part of the game as a referee. I feel like it's so rewarding in the fact that it's the closest thing to playing the game, because your partners are your teammates. You feel all the emotions and all the energy, the atmosphere, you feel all of it. Because as a coach, you know, you can only do so much to, you know, impact the game.
Is officiating your full-time job?
It is. Yes.
Yeah. Good for you. That's awesome. Well, Christine, I really enjoyed listening to you tonight. I learned a lot myself. I'm looking to go back and learn more and listen. I think a lot of the listeners truly appreciate it too. So what else would you like to say in closing to the audience of dedicated officials that are listening in?
Yeah, be true to yourself. Do the work. and, you know, find a mentor.
Thank you so much for your time tonight. I look forward to doing it again sometime in the future.
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Crown Refs Podcast. Serve the game.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If our podcast has brought you any value in the past, then we would love if you considered joining our mentor program and private community for officials. You can go to patreon.com/crownrefs to get started today.